National Gallery Podcast.
Hello, this is the National Gallery Podcast, and I'm Miranda Hinckley. Coming up, a trip to the theatre in 18th century Venice, plus all the gossip from Paris, courtesy of two paintings by French artist Edouard Vuillard. But we start in festive mood. Artworks are regularly imagined as windows onto other worlds, a metaphor that will be brought to life throughout December by six National Gallery paintings. They've been recreated in 3D glory in the Christmas windows of Fortnum & Mason. The store's just a short walk from the gallery, so I went along to meet Mark Connolly, an expert on the history of Christmas, and Paul Symes, the man behind the window's design.
Well, normally, of course, Fortnum & Mason is renowned for doing story windows, but this year we decided that we'd try and go a little bit highbrow and choose something that, rather than encourage a child or somebody to pick up a book and read it, that it might encourage them to go and visit an art gallery. And I wanted to choose those particular paintings because I felt that, you know, I wanted people to be able to recognise them. Might not be able to recognise all of them, but somewhere, even if it's a picture that their granny might have had hanging above the fireplace that she got from Boots, the chemist's, those were repro, that they could actually say, I've seen that somewhere before. The problem we have with our windows is they're quite small and they're not very deep. So to try and construct a 3D effect in those windows, to give you the impression that really, if it was real life, you'd be somewhere around the ground floor by the time you got to the back of it. So what we decided to do was to put them in a gallery setting, so that therefore it was as if people were walking past the windows and actually were transformed into a gallery, which made it a lot easier because then we could make the frame smaller and then, as far as the 3D effect, actually take it back so it actually looked real.
And you have also reconstructed that sense of being in a gallery fantastically well, because not only do the windows feel like frames, but you've also got sort of behind and beyond the paintings little glimpses of sort of other galleries or other rooms.
Well, this is where the National Gallery were brilliant, because they even gave us sort of like details on the frames and also on their wallpaper, which we bought from B&Q for £8 a roll. Not the same, but similar, within my budget anyway.
Well, we've also got with us Mark Connolly, who's an expert on the whole business of Christmas and Christmas window dressing. And it actually goes back quite a lot longer than you might think, doesn't it, to the 19th century?
Absolutely. Window dressing really starts to mature in the mid-19th century, but explodes from about 1870 onwards with the growth of department store culture in Britain, which it imports from France and more particularly from Chicago.
And what was the idea behind providing these window displays? I mean, obviously they're very attractive and they kind of draw people in.
Absolutely. It's all about getting shoppers to come in and open their wallets and their purses. And in Britain, one of the great inspirations was, of course, the great Gordon Selfridge, who had worked in Chicago with Marshall Field. And he had worked there with their brilliant window dresser, L. Frank Baum, the author of The Wizard of Oz. And if you think about that novel, its visuality, you know, which MGM captures so brilliantly, he was clearly a master of window designs.
What would the impact have been on people at the time? You know, you go from having sort of more modest shops to suddenly having these, you know, glorious kind of lavish architectural pieces.
Well, it's absolutely stunning. The press start to pick up on this by the 1880s, and it's clear that competition is indulged in by the London stores for whoever can have the best window. So I can give you some sort of wonderful examples. In 1921, Harrods has a full Swiss chalet that it puts into its main window, which backs into the shop, and it has all its staff in ski outfits. They must have, you know, sweated out pounds in the run-up to Christmas. A year later, D.H. Evans goes for something completely and utterly exotic and oriental, has a full-gone Ottoman harem complete with servants and bowls of goldfish and mannequins as Turkish princesses. And it's noted in the press, you know, that people cluster around the shop windows, and indeed extra policemen are put onto the streets at times to ensure that the traffic can pass easily and to ensure public safety, because there are so many people wedged against shop windows.
Paul, the lovely thing about these windows is that not only will they tempt people into Fortnum & Mason, but they'll also throw people back to the gallery.
Well, yes, I mean, that again was you know, behind the thought process, as I've always thought that, you know, if one person who's never visited a gallery before looks at our windows and, you know, can go down to the National and see it and stand there, as opposed to sitting in front of television, then we've done our job. And also, you know, we're all part of the same thing. I mean, window dressing is a bit like creating a painting from word go. You start with an empty canvas, and every time you do it, it's something you have to produce something different. So, to be quite honest, you know, art, galleries, windows, there's a stronger link than people might think.
Thanks to Paul Symes and Mark Connolly. And now to our major exhibition, Venice, Canaletto and his rivals. It's a much-repeated fact that Canaletto began his career as a set painter for the theatre. But what's less well-known is that several of his rivals in the art of 18th-century view painting also had strong links with the world of theatrical design. Leah Caribbean met up in the exhibition with Italian theatre historian Julie Dashwood to find out more.
Julie, we're standing in front of a view of the massive courtyard of the Doge's Palace in Venice, painted by an artist called Michele Marieschi. It's thought he may have spent some time in Germany as a set designer for opera before he painted this work. But looking at this picture, I mean, apart from the dramatic fall of sunshine that hits the palace buildings on the right, I have to admit that I'm struggling to see any real connection between it and theatrical design. I mean, how does it look to you?
If we go back to the beginning of the 18th century, the perspective, the viewpoint, will be that of the patron or the nobility sitting in the front centre of the auditorium with everyone else more or less distanced from what was happening on the stage and not getting the same perspective. Now, what is said to be one of the great discoveries of the early 18th century is the use of multiple diagonal perspectives on stage, not just from the point of view of a single perspective, going to a vanishing point in the centre, but giving you different angles from the stage and different exits and entrances. And one effect of this, of course, was to create a greater sense of wonder without the need for great architectural buildings on stage.
I see. So this sort of plunging perspective that comes in at a diagonal that we have in this picture is actually something that is quite closely related to set design. But I'm just wondering about this lighting that's really very particular here, and the very bright sunshine on the right and the deep, deep shadow on the left. Did set designers, in fact, actually have to paint in light effects like this?
No, they designed them, but they had different ways of lighting the stage, which were really, for the time, quite flexible, considering they were using candles and oil lamps and reflectors and balls full of coloured water with candles behind them to create different effects, and using transparent materials which they could put lighting behind. But one of the things that they did do with lighting was to begin to dim the auditorium, so that the stage was highlighted and the action on the stage became much more in focus for the spectators. That's possibly something that's happening here. There are spectators, of course, on both sides in the palaces on both sides of the painting, and it's as though one set of spectators is looking at another set of spectators across this very, very strange division in the painting itself.
So he's created both a sort of stage and auditorium within the same work.
Yes, he has. And lots of different entrances and exits. There's a canopy there and that wonderful monumental staircase, of course, which was beloved of painters and scenic designers at the time.
I mean, in the light of all this, I mean, the fact that there is actually quite a close correspondence to the theatre, I'm wondering what you'll make of another picture in the exhibition, painted by an artist who's rather nicely named Antonio Jolly. So if you could go and have a look at it. Jolly's interesting because, unlike Marieschi and Canaletto, in fact, he continued to paint and design sets for opera throughout his career. But having said that, I mean, this painting shows one of the most common views of Venice. It's one we're still familiar with today, showing the Doge's Palace and the Campanile di San Marco in St. Mark's Square, seen from the waters of the Bacino di San Marco. And the foreground is full of ships and a procession of splendid gilded gondolas bringing the Apostolic Nuncio, Monsignor Stoppani, to Venice. But really, I mean, this surely can't have anything to do with set designs. I mean, ships and boats and the rest of it, can it?
It can. The Renaissance stage, and in this, the Baroque stage is not a break. It's a continuity of what happened in the Renaissance. They loved special effects, and they loved being able to create the effect of water and rain on stage and bringing in all kinds of machines. They had cloud machines, you see the clouds here. They could bring the gods down from the clouds. In one spectacle at Versailles, apparently the whole royal family with Louis XIV was brought down from the clouds onto the stage. So this kind of creation of spectacle was possible. Here, of course, Joly is able to bring it all into one painting. And he creates a kind of stage, a sort of dark audience side, if you like, of the people on the Dogana and the boats at the front. And then on the right-hand side, he's got the action more with the boat coming in there, with what looks like a merchant ship coming in there, and the lighted gilded barges bringing in the papal nuncio. So again, it's as though the darkened auditorium, if you like, is on one side, and the real action, the bigwigs, the grandees, are coming in to play out their parts on the water, which is their stage, and then going into the city, which is their stage.
That's wonderful. Thank you very much indeed.
Leah Caribbean was speaking to Julie Dashwood. If you're in London during December, Venice, Canaletto and His Rivals is open throughout the month. You can buy tickets at the gallery or online with a booking fee at www.nationalgallery.org.uk. Sometimes the stories that surround the making of artworks can be as interesting as the scenes they depict. Take The Lunch and the Garden at Vassouy, two paintings by the French artist Édouard Vuillard. They were commissioned by Jean Schopfer, a writer who published under the pen name Claude Anet. Schopfer was a dandy whose wide-ranging accomplishments included being the first tennis player to win the French Open and the first man to drive a motor car in Persia. In Vuillard's paintings, he relaxes in a summer home in Normandy with a group of Parisian friends. And as curator Anne Robbins explained, there's plenty of gossip to unearth, both inside and outside the frame. She began by pointing out a key figure in The Lunch.
Yes, the one standing in the white dress was Jean Schopfer's wife, Alice, his first wife. She was American, born Alice Weatherby, and we know that they had married in 1895, and that the wedding was described in the New York press of the time as one of the prettiest ceremonies that had ever happened. So this is Alice, whom he's going to divorce in 1903.
So all of this sort of very happy scene fell apart. I mean, they got divorced.
Yes, they gave a huge party to celebrate the installation of the decorative panels in their flat. And as early as 2 years later, the couple fell apart and they divorced. Alice went to California with her daughter, who's the baby depicted in the panel there. And Jean Schopfer managed to salvage these panels from the divorce settlement. And then at last, they are reinstalled in a new Paris apartment that he shares with his new wife in 1910.
Which must have been a bit strange, because there he is remarried in a lovely new Paris apartment, and there's his ex-wife staring down, looking really pleased about the whole thing.
Yes, well, but, you know, apparently his new wife, so Clarisse Langlois Schopfer, coped with this for 20 years, for no less than 20 years, because it's not until 1935 that she will ask Vuillard to rework on the composition. So, you know, I see your point. It's not something I could have coped with personally.
And then what changes did she ask Vuillard to make?
Yes, well, first we know that Vuillard was a regular visitor to the Schopfer marriage, and he would come and see his panels in the dining room, and he was growingly discontented about them. You know, we read in his diary, he says, I went to lunch to Jean and Clarisse, and I saw my gloomy old panel. So we know that by then he had got a bit fed up with them. And then Jean Schopfer finally dies in 1931. And it's Clarisse, it's his widow, who asked Vuillard to rework on the panel. We should say that it's quite important that there were initially one large single panel, and Clarisse asked Vuillard to divide them into two and also to rework some of the figures and the foliage. The way he has reworked Alice's face, she looked very happy and jolly in the initial painting, and here he has given her this air of a slight melancholy.
But yes. There's a lot of Jean Schopfer in this, but there's also a lot of Vuillard, because his mistress is in these panels.
Yes, so Lucie Essel was the wife of Jos Essel, who was, from 1900 onwards, Vuillard's main patron, friend and patron. And she was the host of this gathering in 1901. La Terrasse was the villa the Essel couple rented in Normandy. But in the first version of the panel, Vuillard chooses not to depict the Essels themselves, even though they were hosting the party, which is funny in itself, odd in itself. But then when he comes back, when he returns to the composition and reworks it in 1935, by then more than 30 years have elapsed, and by then Le Tout Paris knows that he has developed this relationship with her, and he's not so circumspect about showing her in the painting, and he does so very prominently, actually, because you could argue that she appears from not appearing at all in the initial composition. She's now there three times. So she's here with her hand on her chin. You can just make up her semi-profile. Mm-hmm. She's also there in the garden as a lady in a flirty white dress, holding her hat.
The flowers.
Yes, mm-hmm. Exactly, and with a hat. This very graceful, elegant figure. And he's also added the dog, who wasn't in the initial composition and was actually Lucie's dog. So it's a sort of, it's another way of alluding to her.
This is definitely a case of art imitating life and the paintings going through similar sort of upheavals and, yes. You know, reflecting the changing private lives of both the patron and the artist.
I mean, there's a lot to be read in a painting like this. If you, I mean, you need to know the background story and who these people were and what kind of changes the painting has gone through. But it's a novel in itself. I think Vuillard is very open about it.
Anne Robbins talking about The Lunch and the Garden by Vuillard. In keeping with the painting's origin as a single panel, you'll find them hung together in room 46. That's it for this month. If you're visiting, do make time for our display of Bridget Riley's recent paintings. One of the most significant and original artists of our time, Riley has long been inspired by the National Gallery's collection. This is your chance to see her work alongside that of the old masters, who have influenced her use of colour and line. You'll find the display in the Sunley Room. Admission is free. Season's greetings from all at the National Gallery. Goodbye.